everyone, and welcome to Talk Nerdy. Today is Monday, November 23rd, 2020, and I'm the host of the show, Cara Santa Maria. And November 23rd is a special day. You want to know why? Because it's my mom's birthday. Everyone say, happy birthday, Cara's mom. No, she has a name, it's Charlotte. She was actually on the show. You should check out that episode. I can't remember if it's called Cara's Mom, but it's fascinating. I got to interview my mom. Like, that, how cool is that? Anyway, I'm getting off topic. I have a super exciting show for you today. Before we dive into it, though, I do want to thank those of you who continue to make Talk Nerdy 100% free week after week for everybody to download. And you do it by supporting the show in whatever way you can. Of course, you can shop at talknerdymerch.com. You can rate and review on Google Podcasts or Apple Podcasts or Stitcher or all the different podcast services, leave a review. That's super, super helpful. And of course, the other way is to visit patreon.com/talknerdy. And I want to give a big shout out to this week's top patrons. They include Michael Gaucher, Mary Neva, Christopher Pitts, June Sapara, Pasquale Gelati, Ulrika Hageman, Dudas Infinitas, Charles Payet, Brian Holden, Pedro M. Rosario Barbosa, Daniel Lang, David J. E. Smith, Robert Christ, and Elise Christie. Thank you all so, so very much. Okay, let's talk about this week's show. I have the most exciting guest for you guys. So not only is she a co-founder of NPR's Invisibilia, she's also the co-host, newly joined. She's been on the team for a long time, but newly joined as the co-host of Radiolab. Woo! Oh my gosh, congratulations. And she's the author of an incredible book that I highly recommend for all of you. It's called Why Fish Don't Exist, A Story of Loss, Love, and the Hidden Order of Life. Her name is Lulu Miller. You're going to love her. So without any further ado, here she is, Lulu Miller. Lulu, thank you so much for joining me today.
Yes, thank you for having me in this nerd safe space you have created. Yay. For us all.
Yay. I have to say, the very first thing, you know how you have these like first impressions of people based on really superficial things that have nothing to do with them at all.
Right,
and
row.
One of the most obvious ones is somebody's name, because it's sort of the first thing you see. It's written in print before you even meet somebody. You see their name. And Lulu speaks to me on this really deep level because my grandmother's name was Lula. And when I was born, my parents were like, well, we don't want to call her Lula, but we want to give her something similar. So my middle name is Louise, named after my grandma. And Lulu is anymore just not a very common name, but it evokes sort of like my grandma for me.
Oh,
yeah.
I love that. Well, I'm sort of named after my grandpa Louis. But usually what I get is like, I have a dog named Lulu. So I'm very pleased that your association with me is human.
And it's so kind of like a very classic 1940s kind of, there's something really cool about it. And I feel the same way about my middle name, Louise. I hated it when I was young. And now that I'm older, I'm like, Louise is so like mod. I love it.
Well, I actually hated my name growing up so much. And I am formally a Louisa.
But
I've been called Lulu my whole life by everyone. My mom really loved the Little Lulu comics, which was this little like 1940s girl in a dress getting into trouble. So I'm kind of named after her, really. And I just thought it was weird and I didn't want to stand out. And I thought it sounded like a cow or like a 1920s like flapper. It just, I don't know. And so I hated it. And then at some point kids were like, that means toilet in British, Lulu. And I hated it. And so when I went to summer camp, I went for like 8 weeks sleep away. Like I was gone. I had a different identity there. And my middle sister came up with the idea that she was like, if you hate it so much, why don't you go by something else there? So I went by Lizzie for like 7 or 8 years. I had a summer identity where I was Lizzie because my middle name is Elizabeth. And like Lizzie was normal. Like I was like, Lizzie, I don't know. I made all my friends and my family address letters to me as Lizzie because I didn't want anyone to know I was actually a Lulu. Anyway,
how
but then
funny.
I came to love it. Then I eventually came to like it. But
it's so strange how much like this very arbitrary label, like, and I don't want to out my friends, so I'm not going to say who they are, but I have some dear friends who just had a baby girl and they've already had two boys and they named her and, you know, they were like, oh, figure out a name. Okay, we named her. And then like after a couple of months, they were like, this name isn't right. So they went through the whole process
of
changing her name legally because it just wasn't right.
I know, which is good for them to like push through all the red tape to realize like a bad call.
Right. And it is a lot of red tape. They had to like put a notice in the newspaper.
Oh, to see if anyone wants to object.
I guess so.
Or something. So I think weird. Also that it's on the paper trail for history, maybe. So that
maybe.
You can. That's so wild. And they were like, we are going to change Apple just to Sarah. Never mind. Like,
And then it's like this whole thing we were talking about it the other day with a big group of our friends. We're like, does anybody have a name that their parents were going to name them, but they changed their mind? And I was like, I do. My mom was going to name me Sally.
Okay. Don't like, you hate on that name because that is my number one girl name if we have a girl down the line.
Yes!
But don't know. You can hate on it. I don't care. I'm immune. My mother-in-law has similarly been like, that's the worst name. And I'm like, Kate, you can't because I want it and I'm going to defend it. And my wife's like a hard maybe on it. But
hard maybe. That's good. That means you're halfway
is
there.
So sweet. It's like cheerful, classic. Have you ever met a down Sally?
No. I have not. That's
right?
true. Which is why it probably would not suit me very well because cause my entire career is focused on death and dying. Dr. Sally might be kind of weird. No, it's so funny though, because I think about it and I'm like, I'm such a Kara. Yeah. I would never be a Sally.
Yeah.
Like probably my personality would be different if I had been. It's so weird that a physical label, like not even physical, a literal, a figurative label actually can be conceptualized in such a way that it affects how you think or feel. Like you said, Sally is so bright and sunny and cheerful. You meet someone named Sally and you're instantly like, she's probably nice.
Yeah.
Probably
was
nice
that
girl.
Your sneaky segue into my book? Like a label has power on the natural objects it describes and is not actually an inert linguistic thing you slap on the air.
Maybe.
But yeah, no, it is weird. I remember early days of Radiolab, there was once a story that mentioned something like this. And the little throwaway thing, which we should now fact check in today's world, was like that men named Dennis were more likely to be dentists. And that like that there is some weird like effect, you know, probably very small, but that it your name influences what you become, your career, and just that there are, yeah, there's this kind of magnetism both of what you think for yourself and others expect for you. And there's a million examples of people who it has nothing, you know, doesn't do that, but that there is
true.
Some little little magnetic effect on that. Which
absolutely.
Is crazy.
It's you're right. It's fascinating. It absolutely speaks to your book. I think, though, before we dive into why fish don't exist, we should talk a little bit, though, about like some of the new things that have happened for you. Because as of the time when we first reached out to start to schedule this, it was like, oh, let's talk about your new book. But of course, since then, all sorts of amazing changes have happened in your life. So you ultimately started in radio. Let me see if I'm getting this right. You started in radio working as a producer on Radiolab, right?
Yes, correct.
Okay. So you've been doing that for a while now. And then you started doing science reporting for NPR.
Yep.
And then now what has happened more recently?
Yeah. So I've just been like producer is this big term that just means anything and everything, which is one of the things I love about radio. Like it might mean reporting, it might mean interviewing, it might mean cutting tape. And so I got in the early days of Radiolab. I had no journalistic experience, but I freaking adored it. I heard it on the radio and was like, ah, you are asking my big existential questions that are vaguely spiritual through science. And that makes me feel safe and cozy. And so then I, you know, it wasn't national. I punked the system. I lucked out. I ended up getting a job there and was there for 5 years. And then kind of had this hankering to try to work on writing and ended up leaving and doing, you know, kind of starting the book and doing that for a bit. And then I met Elise Spiegel and we went and started Invisibilia, which was similar to Radiolab in that it's conversational, but it was exploring more psychology and human behavior. And then this book, then I had a baby and this book was like half written. And I eventually said to them, you know, I think I just need to dial back for a bit to work on that. And so I was working on the book, and then we kind of all at Invisibilia decided to pass the torch on to a new generation of reporters who'd been on the show to host. And like, we all kind of went our different ways. And it was right around then that Robert Krulwich of Radiolab retired, the co-host. And so they were looking for someone to fill his big shoes. And so they realized they needed two people. And so I got to come with Latif Nasser, who's a longtime director of research there. And we are the two new co-hosts as of September of Radiolab, which still feels incredibly surreal to say. So we're there with Jad. And it's just like, it has been, I cannot tell you, it has been so much fun to be there. Like, I mean, it's the craziest time on earth. Fun is a strange word to say right now. And
yeah,
with everything, but to have kind of been on my own for quite a bit with the book and doing some freelancing, and then to just cannonball into this team of like 16 people who are passionate. They're, you know, they're curious. They're reporters. They make their own music. They all have different interests. They like grumble their eyebrows and like debate intricacies of how, what a piece should be saying, but in this like really satisfying way where they just care that much. Like After basically working with just the voices in my head for a couple of years, it's like the biggest breath of fresh air. And so, yeah, we've just been volleyballing show ideas around and reporting crazy things. And it is, yeah, it's, I mean, 2 months have gone by, 3 months almost in just a blink of an eye. And it's so exciting to be there. I can't even tell you.
Was this scary at all when you were first asked, like to think about what that means for you, not just like the change in your life or any sort of notoriety that would come along with it, but the sort of flip from doing a lot of behind the scenes stuff to being a voice? I mean, in a way you already had done that before. So that might've helped to be able to represent the show because of Invisibilia. But was it scary for you when they said, hey, do you want to do this? Were you like, I don't know? Or was it just all pure excitement?
I mean, it's still scary. Like last week was a low confidence week the whole week. I was like, can I live up to this? Am I going to be the right kind of wingman to all these incredible producers who need someone to inspire them and clip them back and point that, like, can I do this? I don't know. You know, it was and continues to be scary despite, you know, smiles and cheer. Like, it's terrifying. It's huge. It is huge shoes to fill and to try to also help to just, help the show evolve too, to not just try to recreate it. And that's something everyone there is hungry for, is like, what is our new direction in this moment? You know, like, what does reporting mean in an era where we still can't really go anywhere? And what does the world need? Do they want escapism? Do they want to dive straight into the mechanics of how the virus works or how, you know, the social situation is going? There's all these questions of what the show should become is in the air. And there are days where I'm just like, am I going to be a constructive force in here? It's terrifying. But it's also, I mean, I think honestly, like the feeling when it came up was just like literally like the word right in my heart, and with like Broadway lights around it. I was just like, oh my gosh, this was the show that pulled me into audio, that pulled me into journalism as someone who's a little shy, honestly, like who didn't ever think she'd end up in this world. It's where I learned how to cut tape. It's where I felt some sort of hole punched through the wall of existence of just like, there might be more beneath here if you ask the right questions and listen long enough and fall into the intricacies and the mechanics of the world. They're actually a strangeness. So for me, it felt like I get to come back to these people and learn from all the new people who've been here for a decade since I've been gone. And I don't know, it's both. I think the rightness and the fear combined to create what just feels surreal. It still feels really surreal. Yeah.
I love that. It makes me wonder a little bit, like, what was the sort of compare and contrast of the experience of writing a book, which, you know, for some people, it seems like it comes easier than it is fair. And for other people, it's like, oh, writing is the worst thing in the world. You know, that classic, like, I hate writing, but I love to have written. That it's, you know, some of the hardest things some people undertake in their entire lives. And so I'm wondering what that process was like for you to take on such a daunting task.
Yeah, I think I would err more toward the, like, that was so hard and I don't know if I'll ever do one again.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But I do think, I should know who this was, but someone, I think it was Ann Patchett, but it might be someone else, wrote that that often the idea is like this beautiful, the idea of a book or a story is like this beautiful blue butterfly that you just, it's like just out of reach, but you think if you can catch it, you could like pin it to the paper and then everyone else could see it. And then you never quite catch that thing, but you just keep trying. But that sensation, that's what, you know, I kind of started the book and then put it aside for years while we were starting Invisibilia, but it was still like the butterfly of it was still nagging at me. And then getting the time, like the full year to really throw myself into it, it was this constant feeling that there was something beautiful and that all these disparate ends did connect. And I'm taught, you know, like my personal feelings and this obscure taxonomist and ideas about evolution. And I like had, and self-delusion, and I had this sense, and fish taxonomy. And I had this sense that like those five strands really came together, but I could not articulate it to anyone. When I would try to explain the book idea to someone, their eyes would dull over so quickly. And like, look, people would look at me with concern. and so I quickly learned to be like, I'm writing about a mad scientist from the 1800s. Okay.
But, they're like, ooh, neat. Right.
Yeah. But yeah, but so like I think the entire experience of it really almost till the very end was like, I feel like I'm trying to scale a mountain, but I'm also trying to build the mountain. And I don't know if I'll get to the top.
Right.
And I don't know. It just was this constant out of reach thing. And it required like this mix of faith where you're like, they will add up if I just keep going. But then also kind of enough openness of investigating that maybe they don't, and investigating the strands, which ultimately leads you to the end. So it was like a nauseating, it's like that. It's the confidence thing again of, mm-hmm. of like, who am I to even be doing it? Will it get anywhere? And you have to have faith in yourself to do that. And a lot of days that's hard to find, you know?
See, this is why I like to ask these questions, because I think a lot of people, and some of the feedback that I get about Talk Nerdy is that like, maybe I talk around the topics too much. Like, you have an author on, they wrote a book, ask them about the damn book. And I'm like, no, I want to know about their process.
Yeah.
I want to know about their personal. But I think part of the reason that I do that is because ultimately it normalizes a lot of our own sort of fears that all of us live with. Like, to see that somebody who has a really successful book, somebody, you know, that has been praised by so many different people and has made so many lists, has the same struggles in writing it, has the same sort of fears that maybe I'm not good enough, or maybe like this is never, ever going to come together. It's so helpful because it makes sort of me and hopefully the listeners of the show feel a little less alone, a little less alien, a little less crazy in our own skin.
Yeah. And I do think time helps. Like if I've learned anything from it, it's to kind of like, on one hand, yes, the drudgery, show up and write it on shitty days. Like, it's fine. Just, you know, your editor will come, your editor of yourself even can come out later, but let yourself write and don't judge it too hard. And that's all great. And that is really important. But I also think like, there are these moments where you get excited about something or you know, the winds shift and your mood shifts and you just get a little relief where mm-hmm. writing feels fun or there's an idea you actually want to investigate. And I think I've just learned, seize that mood and get stuff down however you can, even if it's into an audio memo or scribbling it, and then and then let time take its course. And sometimes like getting away from it for a long time helps it, because you change or you fall out of love with a sentence or more story fills in because time adds story. So like that's been something I've just realized. I felt like in this constant rush to finish the book. And from the day I started it till the day it came out was 10 years. And that was 10 years that I felt behind all the time. Right. And if I had just let go of that and been like, it'll be done when it's done, that would have been nicer.
Right. But those, I think those are really important sort of existential themes that a lot of people struggle with. And you can almost compare them to, I don't know, the metaphor that comes up in my head. I do this a lot. Like weird things are evoked when I'm talking to people and I'm like, kind of relates to this. And then once it comes out of my mouth, I'm like,
let's go to random town.
Yes. Thank you. So I think often about like biological urges, you know, things like you need to eat, you need to drink water, even you have an urge to have sex, or some people do. And there are times when you capitalize on those urges. Like, what were the most amazing meals that you ever had? It's when you were really hungry and you like wanted that. And then what were the worst times that you ate? It's when you sort of had to force yourself to eat because you were sick or because you knew that you were going to be in meetings all day. And if you didn't just eat now, you were going to feel like shit later. Or, you know, same thing with sex, like having sex when you were really into it made it so much better, but doing it because you felt obligated or because it had been a while with your partner, you know, whatever the case may be.
Yeah, right. Right.
And yeah, so it's like, it's sort of like in poker. I had Maria Konnikova on again recently, and we talked about the main sort of formula or algorithm of poker, which is maximize your hits and minimize your, or maximize your wins and minimize your losses, because it is random. It's luck of the draw. So like, if you can capitalize on the times when you're flowing and when it's working and when you can just sort of minimize the guilt that you feel when you're swimming upstream, all in on balance, I think that you'll, you know, it'll improve your sort of psychological relationship with your work. But, you know, it's easier said than done.
Right. And it's like, you can know that's what you have to do, but then be in the throes of guilt or self-loathing and be like, cool, it'd be great not to be here. But no, I think that's, I remember with reporting, this is like, I remember Elise Spiegel once said, who just gets the best stories on earth. I mean, she's just a phenomenal reporter. And I forget, there was some story I was working on that wasn't going well. And like, no one was getting back to me or whatever it was. And I was just getting so dispirited. And she was like, oh, the whole work of reporting is maintaining enthusiasm between failures. Yeah. Like, that's the only job. That's how you last in this career. That's how you get good stories. Like, because it's, there's so much failure, you know, like there's stories that don't pan out. There are people who are annoyed to talk to you. There's whatever it is, like, just humiliation and messing up and she's just like, just that is your job. And it's really hard, but like actually just maintaining enthusiasm between failures is the job. And that somehow helped me reframe it of just like, oh yeah, this could be really humiliating, difficult work. And that's the job description. That helped me think about it.
Yeah. You know, I also think about these cliches when it comes to writing. I have a lot of friends who are science writers, and you know, many of them have been very successful in their writing careers, whether it be reporting for outlets, writing books, or both. And there are these cliches you often hear. Like the more complicated one and probably more nuanced one is when you're developing your book proposal, you need to be trying to sell the book that only you could write. Like if anybody else could just scoop it up and write it, it's probably going to be less salient and like, you know, less effective. And I think the simpler version of that is people often say, write what you know. And what I love about Why Fish Don't Exist is that you both, and I mean this in the kindest way possible, fully took that advice and also failed miserably at it. Meaning that like, it's part memoir. It's absolutely what you know, but it's part taking on this investigative experience of like a person that none of us have ever heard of.
Yeah, I know. And like, we didn't even try to write a proposal and writing the description for this thing was so hard. They had to like keep involving higher and higher people up the chain to be like, what is this thing? But I ended up basically submitting like the first draft of like half the book basically and was just like, it's the, I don't know, it's this.
It's like, read this and then you know what the book is.
Yeah. But it is weird. Yeah, I don't know. It's really hard to do the elevator pitch of this book because it just, but I actually, in my heart, I do think it's just, it's kind of what I see it as is kind of like a scientific thriller where, it's like an existential adventure ride where I feel like the title kind of makes it sound like some sort of treatise, but, and maybe I get too dogmatic at times, perhaps, hopefully not intolerably, but mostly it is just a weird story. Like it just is a weird story about a guy and my sort of parallel discovery about him.
And I think oftentimes those are the most successful. Maybe I shouldn't say the most successful because there are different versions and different flavors of science nonfiction writing. But the ones that at least I feel like I'm most drawn to are the ones where the author is not afraid to include themselves.
Yeah.
You know, like you've seen that with Henrietta Lacks. You saw by Rebecca Sloot. You see that in all of Mary Roach's book. You saw it in H's for Hawk.
Yes. Oh, so beautiful.
Yeah. And these are all such beautiful stories where it's like, I get to understand the perspective of the author because she's also telling her own, interestingly, all by women. she's also telling her own sort of parallel process while she's exploring the fascinating experiences of this individual person. So let's maybe dive into David Starr Jordan and like, A, how did you even think to write about him? And B, maybe tell us a little bit more about who he was.
Yeah. So I didn't even know his name when I started out. I just heard this teensy anecdote. I was getting a tour of the California Academy of Sciences, which is a science museum. And they mentioned that there had been this huge earthquake in 1906 and huge amounts of the fish collection had come down in the earthquake. And in this kind of existential moment, the fish were separated from their names. So like the fish weren't ruined, but they were separated from their names. And so how do you know what's what? You have no location data. And it was this just like, to me, just total universe punking of man. It was just like,
so sad, right?
It's so sad. Yes. It's horrible. It's like 30 years of work undone in a second. But then the detail that really hooked me in was that the man in charge of the collection, instead of just saying like, well, you got me, chaos, he began this technique of sewing the label, the scientific name, directly to the fish itself. And the tour guide actually showed us this. He took a hammerhead shark out of a vat. He let us like go into the back room and see it. And he like tugged on the label, which was tied to the eye. Like it felt like this very violent gesture where it was kind of man saying, universe, you will not like escape me. My knowledge will stay tied to you. It almost felt like Peter Pan trying to like attach his shadow. There just felt something fairy tale like to it, or parable like to me. And so I just remember that detail sort of sticking with me for years. I should have been a normal person, completely forgotten about it, but it did just stay with me. And I think it tugged at me almost as a parable. And I think at first I just immediately thought, you are a fool. This is the perfect sign of hubris. Like chaos will continue. You think you can sew your name on and that'll prevent wreckage in an earthquake maybe, but what about fire or rust or flood? Like what about all the other ways chaos could ruin you? And so it seemed to me like an Icarus story, a symptom of hubris. But then as my own life kind of unraveled in different ways, I started thinking about this puzzle of like, sometimes you need to have faith even when there are no signs that like, you know what you're doing or that things are going to work out for you. And on one hand, that felt sinful. That feels like, no, you'll just make a fool of yourself to have faith like that. If the universe is showing no signs that what you're doing is working. But on the other hand, maybe that's how you get things done. And so I suddenly realized this isn't a parable. This isn't a mystery. Whoever this guy was has a name. His life has an ending. Why don't I go research the hell out of him and find out how things ended? And in so doing, as an atheist with no clear moral instruction, provide a little moral instruction. And so that's kind of how I entered the project. Then I learned his name. I learned pretty quickly he would end up to become the first president of Stanford. And so that he became this like people sort of call him the godfather of ichthyology, of fish taxonomy in the United States, which sounds silly, but like most fish biologists apparently will like trace their lineage back to him. He ended up becoming responsible for, at least claiming responsibility for discovering over 2,000 fish. And so he was really prolific and became kind of a huge success by certain measures. And he also happened to leave behind a giant amount of writing. He wrote this huge autobiography. He had journals, he had drawings. And so suddenly I had so much to research, and I don't know why I came out this way, but my happy place is primary research. So then I just kind of set out on this journey, which involved some real twists and turns, and just became a really interesting story to tell.
Absolutely. And I mean, like, not just in terms of, okay, this happened, and then holy shit, this crazy thing happened, and then look at this crazy thing happened, but a journey that evokes these really deep kind of philosophical themes, and not just esoteric philosophical themes, but themes that have a direct influence on the safety and security and survival of individuals. And that's the part that really speaks to me, is that an ostensibly like weird story about like a sort of mad scientist who's, you know, sewing labels onto fish because they were all shattered and separated, you started to uncover some real darkness, didn't you?
Yeah. And that thing, like, thank you so much for saying that that's where it struck you, because I think honestly, like, I set out to read him like a parable and do a kind of navel-gazy indulgent thing. And I kind of thought it would be an essay. And then it spiraled, honestly, when the story of him just leapt out of my premise, you know, and it like ended up, it wasn't so much that he's a parable. It was that he was a rabbit I was chasing who led me to this very real contemporary situation that I knew nothing about. And I think my hope is that at a certain point in the book, it just breaks free of his narrative and leads us to this place where there are people surprisingly affected by ideas he introduced to the world. And that's for me as a reporter, where it kind of, like, I guess I feel like at a certain point in the book, it switches from essayist to reporter. And then I just meet these women and meet these people who were the ones that actually gave me the kind of instruction that I think has changed my life a little bit.
Right. And that's the point where it sort of switches over too, from being, you know, dusty history that just exists in a vacuum, to being like, holy shit, this is relevant right now.
Yeah.
And it's important for us to talk about. So maybe we can dive into that instead of sort of like, I do this a lot on the show, like talk around things. And then my listeners are like, I haven't read it. I don't know what you're talking about. So like, tell me about this darkness.
Yeah. So basically, David Starr Jordan was very interested in ordering the world. And he believed, when he was younger, he believed in the idea of a divine hierarchy, that there are some creatures that are just better, that are higher morally than others.
Let's guess, but humans would be involved in that.
Humans would be right at the top. There are angels
of humans
above us. Yeah. White privileged men would be at the tippy top. Mm-hmm. And he did, you know, and you know, monkeys are below us, then you get, you know, lizards and fish and snails. And he ostensibly, as he grew as a scientist, abandoned this model. He said, that's foolish. I have come to believe in the ideas of Darwinism. He talks about reluctantly giving up this idea, which was a moment I really loved him. He said, like, going over to the evolutionists was like, I was like a cat being dragged by the tail across a carpet. And I liked that he was honest. Like, it was hard to let go of that sense of order, but he did it because he was a scientist and he was interested in theory, seeing truth. And one of the things that at first made me fall in love with him was that as a boy, he had been really picked on. He was really into nature. And he came to believe that, like, the work of being a good scientist and a good taxonomist who's interested in figuring out the order of the world is to care for the hidden and insignificant. That was kind of his North Star. And his other thing was to reject books and look to nature for truth. So he was wary of belief, he was wary of certainty, and he wanted to care about the things that were overlooked. So I thought those are really good North Stars. And yet, somewhere along the way, as much as he said he let go of this idea of a divine hierarchy, you could see that he still just carried it with him, and he slowly sort of took the ideas of evolution and got on board with the eugenics movement, and not only got on board with it, which is this idea that you can create a master race by breeding out people who are less fit or unfit is the term, which is a scientific sounding term for just utter judgment, subjective judgments about who you want around and who you don't. And he wasn't just one of the many scientists who kind of saw some sort of, you know, resonance in these ideas. He was like one of the most key important players in the American eugenics movement. He helped bring it over from England, the ideas. He helped legitimize it in universities. He helped get laws passed to require the sterilization of people in America deemed unfit. And so the first part of my learning was just like how popular eugenics were in America and how much we were kind of ahead of the Nazis, like that, you know, we're so often told this story, at least I was. Maybe schools have gotten better, but I was told the story of sort of Nazis as the other against which, the evil other against which we define our national identity. That's like the one thing America got right. We fought them.
Right.
Of.
And that the Nazis were like the architects of eugenics, which is really not true.
They just
were able to do it unencumbered in a way that like it would never really was able to be fully instituted here. But the starts were pretty severe, and really we sort of set the standard for the
Nazis. We were the first in the world to pass a mandatory eugenic sterilization law. The Nazis had an early poster that said we do not stand alone, and there was an American flag on it because we'd already passed so many laws. So that was kind of part one of my very belated edification about that. And just what a key role. So David Starr Jordan, he wanted to look at order in fish. He starts seeing it in people. He starts writing books. He had traveled to this town in Italy, which had been a sanctuary for people with disabilities and mental illness for hundreds of years. And many people see in that town a kind of like beautiful refuge for people who are vulnerable, where people are allowed to flourish. And he called it, quote, a chamber of horrors. And he wrote this book called The Human Harvest, in which he said that if we didn't take action, the species of man would devolve into a lower creature. And so he just, some of his words, reading these books, these old eugenics texts, that's when I really started to see how passionately behind the movement he was. And I guess one of the most painful things about his story is like he never really had to pay for his sins. Like he went to the grave in bliss, believing he was a hero for this kind of work, which he said would ease suffering in society. And his work, helped to kind of gain the momentum that eventually led to the Buck v. Bell case, the famous Supreme Court case in 1927 that ruled in favor of mandatory sterilization for anyone deemed unfit, a law, a ruling that has never been overturned. So like at our highest level.
Oh my God.
Yeah. And so that was a huge what moment for me. And then I talked to tons of legal scholars who were like, yeah, but don't be so alarmist. Like every state has overturned it. So there's no, you know, it's in this purgatory where there's not actually a way to sterilize people. But then I kept talking to people. And when you drive down into the legal language, almost half of our states actually still do have a loophole in the law that allows for the mandatory sterilization of people deemed unfit. Only now they use terms like mentally deficient or unable to give informed consent. So like we have different fancy words, but there are people who don't have a say in the matter. And
it's not like this is theoretical. Like we've seen in the detainment centers, like we've seen the news starting to pop up. We have been living for 4 years under the I don't know what I even want to call his presidency, under the rule, the reign, the, you know, failed dictatorship of an individual who has proven to us that we cannot rely on the legal structures and the constitutional structures, because they only work if everybody is in it for the same, like, moral reasons. And when you have somebody who's like, let's see how much we can bend it before it breaks, oh shit, it's a lot more fragile than we thought.
Absolutely. And the, yes, exactly. And what astounded me was that sterilization went on in a kind of mainstream way all the way up until the late 70s. But then it continued in these ways, some of which were, you know, illegal. Like, there was this famous case about 4 years ago that ProPublica discovered that 150 women have been sterilized in California prisons. And that's continuing to go along in other places where that was just blatantly illegal. There was a judge in Tennessee who was offering sterilization to criminals for reduced sentences. Oh my God. And again, like, the thinking there is, if your that theft or whatever this crime is, like, if we can just create it so you won't be around anymore, the world will get better. That is pure eugenic ideology. Like,
which is absolutely divorced from reality. I mean, it's absolutely divorced from all of the social issues that exacerbate these problems.
That requires someone to steal something. Absolutely. Yeah. And all of the, you know, all of the eugenics ideas have been so just roundly disproved on all point, like, on, you know, just in so many ways, but it's still with us.
Yeah, deviancy, quote unquote, however you want to define that, is, which is so subjective, is not genetic. Like, behavior, all of these kind of behavioral things, criminality, like, and that really, it's funny because when you look back to the earliest eugenics conversations in the U.S., which were actually pretty well accepted, you saw, like, the eugenics booths at the county fairs, and you saw the groups of people getting together to talk about it, and it actually felt, I don't know, I watched a really in-depth, I think it might have been a Frontline about it, or some or an American Experience documentary about it. It actually felt like a civic duty, like something that, okay, if everybody works really hard to make sure that we improve family planning around civic involvement, that the people who care about the greater good are going to reproduce and make babies, and the people who are, you know, ending up in jail or who are, you know, for whatever reason not as engaged, don't make babies, then we'll ultimately have a more kind of civil society. And on the surface, everybody's like, this is a good thing. Really not even imagining the idea that, well, those of us who are making these decisions already have really easy lives, and we have a lot of power, and we're deeming ourselves as the best people here. You know, like, what about subjugation? What about disenfranchisement? What Absolutely. About, you know, like, yeah, what the fuck?
You're pointing to something that was like the secondary learning for me, which was, okay, regardless of all the ways in which they were wrong scientifically, like, or morally, or mm-hmm. you know, no, first, scientifically. So the idea that they were wrong about the fact that, you know, genes cause criminality or illiteracy right. or an inability to speak English, whatever, things that they actually sterilized people for, prevented them from carrying on.
Because they literally thought it.
Are not with us, you know, like, our world is that much more impoverished because they are not, you know, whatever. But then there's also the secondary point of somehow they all happened to skim over or miss in mm-hmm. on the Origin of Species, which was their, you know, Francis Galton, who came up with the idea of eugenics, was Darwin's cousin, and he said the book transformed his thinking, and, you know, was the something, I went back and counted, the something like over 100 mentions of the idea that homogeneity is a death sentence, and that, you know, diversity of creatures, of phenotypes, of genotypes, like, of, he didn't use those words, but the same concepts, that is the sign of a healthy species. It's what will allow your variety. It's what will allow your species. If you are actually interested in creating a master race, you want to create, you want to leave a gene pool that is as diverse as it can be, because you don't know. The human mind is, if Darwin says anything, he says the human mind cannot comprehend the whole machinery of life, quote, the complexity, you know, and that it is, that simply we are horrible at assessing value.
And so they knew this early that, like, from a logistical perspective, a purely logistical perspective, the more diversity, the better. Yet still they were like, but let's all be white.
Except let's all be right. Yeah. And so they're just, but so that, and then the, and then the final point of, like, so that it exists in these illegal ways of the judge and the people doing, but that it's still also on the books. And there are still people, you know, mainly people with disabilities who, like, could be sterilized against their will. And I talked to one woman who had been sterilized against her will. It was a huge grief of her life. And just kind of, you know, have talked to other, a woman who was told she should be sterilized and should never have a kid. And she managed to escape it. And she had a kid. And, like, just getting to hear her with her daughter talk so frankly about the judgments she encounters every day. And but the idea of, like, just don't presume my incompetence, you know, like, if I do something wrong, sure, let the systems that exist for any parent come into place where maybe you have to consider taking my kid away, but don't presume I can't, you know, because of your taxonomic definition of me or filing away of me. And so that, I think, if, you know, if I walk away from the writing experience and the talking to all these people, the experience of it is just like my only faith now is in doubt. Like, I will not believe what a diagnosis. I will not believe that I know anything about a certain group of people. Like, just to just keep having doubt in our categories, our definitions, like, they are proxies, they are totally useful, but there is way more complexity and nuance underneath them. And that sounds hippy dippy, but it feels like very real and important.
No, and for me, that is the biggest takeaway. Like, you know, I think at this point, we've sort of come full circle back to the title of the book, Why Fish Don't Exist. Really, it's about the constructs, the categories, the labels. And for me, as somebody who's training, working towards my clinical psychology PhD, who's seeing patients, you were trained as an MFT, you know, you're currently working as a journalist and reporter, but you mentioned also that your wife is a therapist, right?
Yes, she is. Yeah, she's just like a few months away from finishing up her postdoc. She's working in a hospital, mostly doing therapy with kids.
Amazing. So we've got, like, this sort of interesting parallel between the taxonomic investigation, which just happens to be about fish in your book, and this concept that we often see within the medical model, which is that if we can have a list of symptoms and we can check off those symptoms, then we can label the disease and then we know how to treat the disease, which, you know, works for things to some extent that are pathognomonic. Like, it works for, like, you know, cancer. Okay, but there's a label. We know where it emerged from. We know what receptors it has on it. We know what chemo is going to be, you know, working on it. And I think there's this really deep misunderstanding culturally that mental health is as clean.
Yeah.
Or really that anything is that clean and that it can be categorized so perfectly. I take an existential approach. I'm lucky enough that my school offered orientation choices. So you could either be psychodynamic, CBT, or existential humanistic.
So does existential humanistic mean all of the above? Don't define me. Or wait, what is?
So it's sort of both. It does have its core parameters. It's, like, based on Viktor Frankl's Man's Search for Meaning. It's based on Irvin Yalom's existential psychotherapy. There's a lot of different. It's based on existential philosophy, which
is
there are givens of existence that are really deep, and they underlie most psychopathology, fear of death, meaninglessness, loneliness, the push and pull between freedom and responsibility. Whereas the CBT approach is a much more, like, near the surface approach. That's like, you have a symptom. That symptom is really getting in the way of your functional living. Let's focus on relieving you of the symptom. I think that both things are valuable. I don't think I want to be a practitioner who does CBT work only. I utilize CBT work in my approach to say, okay, let's take care of this thing that's crippling you, like this thing that's making it so that you can't function. And then once we do that, we're going to understand why it keeps coming back and why deep down this, you know, fear of death this overwhelming terror of your own mortality is why you get so anxious every time you have to get on an airplane or, you know, whatever the case may be. And so for me, like one of the things that's amazing about being one of the things that's so amazing, I'm not psychodynamic, about being more existentially oriented is that we're really taught, and most of the existential literature is like, don't diagnose unless you have to for managed care. Like, it really doesn't matter. Whatever the book says you have, who cares? We're treating the person, and the person is not the disorder.
I love that. And I know, like, it's so tricky because names, like, they can be a beautiful campfire that you can come sit around and they can give, like, diagnosis can, you hear so many stories of diagnosis being the thing that saved a person.
Oh, for sure. Like, now I know I'm depressed and I can take this pill and I have therapy and there's all these people that have it too. Like,
but
I know what's
you
wrong.
Hear just as many stories of people for whom the diagnosis feels like a cage. Like, it can either feel like it's a vessel and it can feel like a nest, or it can feel like a cage, or it can feel like whatever other metaphor I'm not thinking of. But it's such a tricky thing. But I think the thing, it definitely is clear to me now how much power these words have on the trajectory of a life. And whether it's just whether it's as official as a diagnosis or it's finding its way into legal policy or even just the kind of thing you're batting around with a friend, like, it's a little scary. And it's honestly, I think I'm getting more used to it maybe, but I don't know that it's starting to talk, like trying to go back into the world of words, writing, but then reporting where like all you have is words to communicate, but having lost faith in words and having so much wariness around words. I have to say, like, all summer when I was doing interviews on this book, I was so tongue-tied more than ever because I was just getting so afraid of any sentence that would spill out because I'd be like, is that what I mean? Wait, is that?
Yeah.
And it is a weird I find myself in a weird moment where, like, I am utterly, I feel like a potter who's looked down to realize their clay is like made of lava. And I'm like, this is dangerous shit we work with.
Yeah.
And it can be great, but you say something wrong and I don't know. So I have a weird relationship to words right now.
I think that's so important. Like, as a science journalist, as a therapist, like, words affect people. There's a reason that we have to have informed consent. There's a reason that we have, you know, specific requirements when we're doing psychotherapy and when we're doing psychological research, because literally words can cause harm. We know this. That's all we're doing in therapy is exchanging words. And we know they can cause harm, which is why we need to be licensed, which is why we have to have, you know, all of this like paperwork. It's fascinating that something that you think of, right, as being intangible and ephemeral can actually affect the physical world. And I think that's where the thing that my paralleled experience to yours of the power of the word and the kind of fear or dis-ease around its correct utilization speaks to my journey as a skeptic. So I've, you know, years and years ago, I was invited to speak at my first skeptic conference. And then I was invited to join the Skeptic's Guide to the Universe cast as one of the podcast co-hosts. And, you know, I think I've, at this point, labeled myself as a skeptic and I'm accepted within to the skeptic community. But my biggest struggle has been that I also really value constructivism. I value this idea that although there is an objective reality, none of us can or have all of the capabilities to know it as it is very well. And we have all these emotional valences and experiential valences and heuristics that we throw on top of it. So our subjective experience of objective reality is never, it's always approximating, but never perfect. And I feel like that's the way that I make sense of this, is that I separate those things. Like, in my view, fish exist, but the label fish doesn't necessarily capture what a fish is. Like, that fish exists. But the idea of fish as a construct is a construct that's laid over the physically swimming fish. And if I can sort of keep those things separate, it helps me.
Yes, But that's beautiful. And I think I'm in that camp too. I don't ultimately, it's not, although I kind of explore a little bit of the philosophical, or I try to get my head around, does a chair exist type stuff. This is more
the, like,
about,
solipsistic stuff of like, am I creating my environment to the extent that you don't have a shared experience? Like, no, the world exists. Like, we know
so
that.
It's much more about, it's about the category. And so it's like, yes, an individual creature that I call a fish. It's there. The book doesn't take any try to take any whack at its existence, but it does take a whack at the category of fish, which I talk about as a gerrymandered category that is maybe intuitive to the human eye, but actually doesn't reflect a meaningful evolutionary relationship in terms of groups of creatures. And there are things, it's a category we can make, absolutely. But if you're interested in how things are related and grouping them together, it's a scientifically useless category.
Absolutely. It's like that. Who was the justice that famously said, like, that I can't define pornography, but I know it when I see it.
Oh, I should know, but I don't.
I know, I should do it off the top of my head. And it's like, okay, everybody just at the surface goes, I get that. And then the second you think about it deeper, you're like, no, fuck you. Like, your definition of pornography is completely different than mine. What are you even talking about?
Yeah, totally. I was just having, I don't remember what it was, but I do find myself curious about a word you used that I've never heard, which was pathognomonic.
Oh, right. So like that in medicine especially, and way less so in psychology or psychiatry, which is medicine, sorry. But let's say mental health versus, I don't know, physiological health. Pathognomonic refers to a symptom that is definitive of the disease. Like if somebody has like yellowing skin, it's pretty clear. Or like if they have jaundice, it's pretty clear what's happening in their body. So there are certain things where it's a constellation of symptoms and you have to do all these differential diagnoses to figure it out. And that's more like mental health.
Right,
and then there are
right.
these other things where it's like, oh, that's pathognomonic of this disease. They have that symptom. I'm pretty sure that's what's going on with them.
Oh, interesting.
And I think that mental health runs the gamut. Yeah. And like, you know, schizophrenia is a little clearer. It's not perfectly clear because they could still be schizoaffective, or they could be bipolar with psychotic symptoms, or they could be, you know, there's a million different ways to label it. But if somebody hears voices that are divorced from any sort of cultural experience of religion or anything like that, they hear voices that aren't there, then it's a little bit clearer to say that symptom is definitive of like only this cluster of disorders. Like even if I can't call it schizophrenia, I can say this person has hallucinations. This person
it's an arrow I have faith in. Like
totally. Yes.
Yeah.
Whereas if somebody's just like, I have genuine like ennui, like or general ennui, and like I don't know if I'm feeling disenchanted with the world. It's like, is that depression? Is that just a normal response to the fucking pandemic? Like, I deal with that a lot because my patient population has cancer, and I'm working with people who are dying, and it's like I have to diagnose them because I work in a hospital. But like, how do you diagnose all the horrible shit that comes along with dealing with the fact that you're dying?
Right.
It's normal. It's normal to feel all these things.
Right. And where is the line between a disorder and just a particular response? And I think you're so right. Like those categories, when it comes to mental health, when it comes to human worth, anything, like we should just, we're a human intelligence, any of that stuff. I'm so wary of the categories. And again, I think they can be useful. Like they can be helpful guideposts, or they can, you know, be proxies, but just to always remember that this is, you know, just to stay curious about what the person beneath the label is saying or trying to explain to you.
Yeah. And I think we actually see a kind of very modern version of exactly that theme in the sort of social justice approach to things like gender or to other types of labels that historically people have felt a sense of real firmness and security in the labels. And so as we see movements at the political level, let's say, I think Portland just rewrote some sort of like city charter or their constitution, and they took out all gendered pronouns. Mm. And it's amazing. Like instead of saying like he or she, it says like the assessor does this.
they move on to that.
And I love that. Yeah.
Yeah, right. It's like such a simple thing, but there is literal like outcry from it because people are like, you're being so PC. I wonder though, I really wonder, does that come from the fear of once the categories become looser, there's a depersonalization, there's a true existential angst that comes out of the lack of scaffolding or security?
Oh, I think so. Right. I think like when you let go of that order, you invite more chaos. Creating an order is a sense that you it's like a set of predictions. It's not just a label, it's a set of predictions about the things beneath the label. And when you make that label too big or you take some away, it's like you're inviting more unknown and chaos into your world. And I think that's uncomfortable. But I also think if we can come to reorient our relationship to chaos a little bit and come to see that there will be gifts within it, that chaos also introduces wildness and surprise. I don't know, but that could maybe be somewhat of an antidote. But yeah, I do think, I think it's like maybe the PC grown but coupled with like a profound, disorienting, unsettling feeling of like, if you take away what I know about gender or, you know, who's disabled or who can get in a school and who can't, like the more you start to carve away at that, the less you know where you stand in the midst of a world that is already chaotic. And so I do think it's a natural response, and like our work of being good humans and humans who can forge constructive paths forward is to be okay with a little of that shaking. But again, I think it's actually the ones to be most cautious about, like, are the words that people say with a certain degree of certainty or sobriety.
Yeah, absolutely.
And it's like, you heard it early days and still with COVID, it's like, well, people with pre-existing conditions either aren't included in the count of how many lives were lost or might not get a ventilator. And it was this jargony term that if you peel back is saying like, there are certain people who don't deserve to live as much, who don't actually count as having got sick. And it's
or like elderly people, like, yeah, well, they're long gone anyway. Like you definitely saw that. Like, well, how many of them were just going to die anyway? And it's like, what?
And it's like, fine, have that debate, but admit what you're saying with like a furrowed eyebrow. And so, yeah, it's that. Yeah, it's just, it's the jargony terms we say with utter just sobriety and lack of curiosity. Those are the ones. And now, you know, it's like where unfit exists on the law books right now are these really complicated terms like unable to give informed consent. What does that mouthful mean? It's saying I'm deciding by some set of metrics that this person can't decide for themselves. And therefore, I can sterilize them. But where that line falls, if you talk to people who are beneath it or who fall right in the middle of it, like it's a terrifying experience. And it's just an outsider judging their ability to make decisions for themselves. And like that is a lot of jargon that today in our laws in our states is still creating a kind of eugenic hierarchy. It just is.
Yeah. And you can't really get, it's funny because like there's the philosophical or ideological conversations, then there's the practical outcomes of them. And then really where we're often existing is somewhere in the middle. And so, you know, I was just doing a training on advanced directives and a lot of these concepts came up, this idea of your medical proxy and like when are you no longer competent or because you're not conscious or you have too much delirium or whatever for somebody to make that decision on your behalf? Have you communicated with them what your wishes are? How does somebody make a decision when they're in such a, I don't know, heightened stress state? And I can think.
Right. And that's a real thing. Like totally. Mm-hmm. That is real.
That's a thing you need to plan for.
And it would be great to have a ton of smart people thinking about what to do.
But it's like, you can't just ignore it altogether, like you said, because it sounds too hippy dippy to just be like, nothing is real and everything is just what we make it. I mean, that's solipsism, right? This like view that like I constructed my own reality. So it goes back to that idea of like, how do I know that what you see as red is the same thing as what I see as red? Well, I know from a physics perspective what your cones and rods look like. And I know also, or from a biological perspective, what your cones and rods look like. And I know from a physics perspective, what wavelength red light is. So those things exist. But what I don't know is the texture and the qualia and the experience and the emotions that are evoked when you see the color red, or what your experience because you have a damaged rod or you're missing a certain type of receptor is. If you can't, you know, functionally experience red the same way because you're red-green colorblind, is it that you can't tell the difference between red and green? Is your red more brownish? Is it more, or is color not even a part of the conversation? So it's like, yeah, it's like neither and both at the same time. And to me, it speaks down to the biggest sort of functional thing that I work towards as a therapist, which is sort of multidimensional. But what it really comes down to is A, holding on to things lightly, which is a concept that we often try to explore. Is how do I hold something lightly? It's like trying to grasp at water or sand. If I cut my hand lightly, I can get some of it. But if I cling to it with a clenched fist, it's all going to fall right through it.
Oh, that's lovely.
Yeah. And it's hard for people to do because our society does not reinforce that. Our society reinforces binary black and white decisions, autonomy. It reinforces labels. It reinforces clear constructs. But the
right
other
or
thing,
wrong choice.
Right or wrong. Yeah. Like literally
like
people
acquiring
believe.
The thing then forever. Yeah.
Oh yeah. Like marriage, for example, like I agree to never change the way I feel ever in my life.
Right.
And you
or
shall do
believe,
the same.
And or to believe that person will stay at the same person over time. Like,
Yeah, instead of everything being iterative, everything being glowing. And the other big kind of construct that I always get to when it comes to therapy, because everybody's definition of why therapy happens and, you know, what is the goal of therapy is different. And these are big, heavy existential questions. And the one that I really come back to over and over is ambivalence. I truly believe that we are not trained societally to be okay with ambivalence. To be okay with the fact that you can feel two different things about the same experience at the same time. We are so forced to choose one or the other. And I think that speaks to taxonomy, too. It speaks to labeling. Like something can have a different qualia. It can be multiple things at once. It can be a fish, but also, you know, reptilian, or a fish, but also mammalian, and it's okay. To be a fish doesn't mean
you're
it can't
so right.
be mammalian.
Or that it's failure of a taxonomist. Yeah, you're right. We do judge ambiguity as like they're wishy washy, they're flip flop. It was ambiguous. It wasn't clear enough. It's so negative. And oh my gosh, I have to. Can I recommend a guest for you for someday?
Yes, please. I'm going to write it down right now.
Okay. I'll be able to get you her contact info. I'm a little biased. She's my middle sister.
Oh, yeah.
And yeah, but she, so her name's Alexa Rose Miller, but she works exactly on this. She was an artist, a painter for many years, and she started getting interested in medical books. And then that led her, it was a weird path, but she started working at Harvard Med School, and she taught this class, co-taught a class called Training the Eye, where she basically had med students look at art, ambiguous works of art often, as a way of improving their diagnostic skills and specifically teaching them how to linger in ambiguity and uncertainty for longer than they want. And
instead of going to that pareidolia of like pattern.
Oh, it means this. Yeah. And so she would do this work, which like, you know, sort of drives people mad. Oh, you think those are wrestlers? Why do you think that? Oh, I don't know, because they're wrestling. Okay, but why do you think they're wrestling? Yeah. Oh, and like again and again and again. And at a certain point, Harvard was like, you got to measure the efficacy of your arty farty class. And I remember her being so pissed and like, some things aren't measurable. Like, and they did this 6-year study and it turned out that, you know, students who went through this class had really noticeably improved diagnostic skills. And just this idea again and again, that like, when you force yourself to stay in this place that is uncomfortable and that has a bad rap, as you're saying, like, then what do? You ask the patient more questions. You maybe pull in a colleague. You do things to get better answers. Like you're constantly checking why you're thinking something before you diagnose. And the metaphor I always think, and she's done tons of work on this since, but this is what she does. But like, it's this idea that staying in ambiguity saves lives. Like that is less death.
Yeah.
That's less diagnostic errors. And so much in our culture, incentivizes us to be exactly the opposite and to see it as some kind of failing. And so she is just, I mean, she's shaped my journalism. She's shaped like my everything.
Oh, and she must have been like a kind of almost like an undercurrent of influence in this book.
Yeah, she is. Yeah. And like she just, and she also was an undercurrent of like having a similar family experience and watching mm-hmm. our oldest sister get misdiagnosed and mm. not fit in. And I think we both kind of went to different places to try to make sense of that. And like, but she went to this really, I don't know, her work is so profound and she's awesome. So that's my shameless sister plug because she's
I love that.
Amazing. She's just
I love that. Yeah. It really does speak to this idea. And I mean, ultimately, that's the big takeaway that I get from your book, which is that like, we have these boxes where we can define them, you know, every way but Tuesday. And then you try and put the thing in the box and it never quite fits. And that's okay. It's okay that we have the box. And it's okay that we really understand that the box is never going to be a perfect fit. Like we can be comfortable with all of those things.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. And that they can be really helpful, but let's keep an eye on how much we believe in them.
Exactly. Yeah. And so, I do a talk sometimes called Is Constructivism a Four-Letter Word for Skeptic Audiences, which is really about that. Because skeptics, I find more than anybody, they're like, postmodernism, F you. Like, that flies in the face of anything I care about as a skeptic. And it's like, well, let's explore why, you know, let's explore what that really means.
Oh, I love that.
Me too.
I want to hear that. Is that like, is that anywhere?
I don't know if there's a recording of it. I can definitely send you the PowerPoint though.
PowerPoint,
so it might not help you that much. But but yeah, there might be a recording somewhere. I'll try and find that. Might be on YouTube. But yeah, so okay. Super excited about our chat. Feel like I could talk to you for like a million more hours, but I know that I can't. I want to know, Lulu, before we start to do some of the wrap-ups, is there anything we, first of all, didn't get to that you wanted to talk about with regards to the book?
Oh, or only really that. Anything? I feel like I should offer you, like, I feel like all your guests have some cool, like, trees migrate, archaeology of Burning Man. Like, I feel like I need to give you a cool factoid.
Oh, please.
And I feel like we've been really existential, which is always where I want to be, but I just want to make sure the listeners get what they want. And here is a favorite factoid from the fish taxonomy researching that fell out of the book, but I just want everyone to know about, which is that during Prohibition, some people broke into the Smithsonian and drank the fucking ethanol from the fish preserving jars to get lit.
That's
how
so
much
disgusting.
They wanted to get drunk, is like fish flavored alcohol. So there's my fun factoid for the day. We actually would need to fact check. I didn't get to the fact checking stage because I didn't put it in the book, but it came from a reliable source. So my fun fact.
I wouldn't be
that's
surprised.
My fun people were, potential fact.
People were like going blind from methanol poisoning. So yeah. I wouldn't be surprised. Can you imagine what that would taste like?
Oh, and like just how bad you... Because
it's not just like fish booze. It's like chemically fish booze that's also like kind of rotty tasting. I just... Oh
yeah, it would not have been pleasant. So I'm so sorry for the people that had to do that. But also, should things ever get real bad, there is alcohol waiting where you least expect it in our nation's haughtiest of places museum. So there you go.
Hopefully you didn't start a trend. I love it. Well, so, okay. On that note, I would like absolutely be remiss if we didn't dive into my closing two questions, which are like the big picture questions. And you mentioned that you had heard the show, so I think you know what's coming. I would love to know from you in your experience, maybe from this new job or from, you know, your experience writing the book or just where things are right now, because we live in, you know, the upside down. Number one, what is the thing that keeps you up at night that you're most concerned about, cynical, pessimistic, all those adjectives? And then, or not adjectives, synonyms, that's the word I was looking for. And then number two, what are you really genuinely optimistic and looking forward to?
I like the order. Love the order of things.
Oh, gotta end on the more positive note for sure.
Okay, so I think the thing that really keeps me up at night is the state of racial reckoning in our country and if we can do anything about it and if I can be anything constructive in it. Like, I think this summer for me has been a much belated education on the ways in which, like, I really am a big part of white supremacy and that I benefit from it and I perpetuate it in ways that, like, I actually thought were good things, like my personality, like I like being a peacemaker and I like, and I'm like, no, these are like out of the book ways that difficult situations aren't confronted. And so I think the thing that is keeping me up the most is like, I see, like, I've just entered a space where I'm a leader. And I'm afraid of confrontation. There are things about seeing just how huge of a problem we continue to have on our hand in every realm of our country and wanting to be a force that helps. And then being like, just looking down at my body and my psychological mechanics and being like, wow, I'm ill-equipped for it. And that's not an excuse. Like, and I gotta, okay, cool, we'll change. And so I think that is like, that is really hard. Like, that's just, I mean, it's not as hard as fucking dealing with racism every day at all. But that's my personal, like, that's where I am right now. It's just like, oof, I don't know. I feel ill-equipped and I feel lost and afraid. And like, it's something I want to work on. And then I just feel my shortcomings left and right.
Right.
So that's my honest answer. That's what is keeping me up at night. And then what I feel genuinely hopeful about is probably the most basic cliched answer, but is like my son. And he is just, my son and the wave of kids around him, like my son is metaphor for a new generation. And just the idea of like, there is a person waking into the world right now and he still has curiosity. He still doesn't know what things are. He's just learning language. He's getting things wrong all the time. You know, he's calling like dolphins, dollfish. And he's, you know, I'm not even making this up. 2 days ago, I mean, it broke my heart, but 2 days ago, he's really into trucks right now. And so he's like dump truck, trash truck, fire truck, da, 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 all these trucks. And we had this little set that was like an ambulance, a medical helicopter, and a police truck. Kind of like a paddy wagon. We didn't get it for ourselves, but anyway, it was given to us and he liked it, it has sirens. So anyway, and so it's police truck and he was saying, peace truck. And I was like, I fucking wish, dude. And my heart broke because I was just like, it is not that. But just a moment of like, here is a creature waking into a world that is changing and quaking beneath us all. And I am feeling my brittleness and my oldness and what I've been formed in. And I still want to change. I've still got a lot of life left, I hope. And like, I can change, but here is someone being formed in a new era. Yeah. And I hope, like, I see him just alive with like so much laughter and joy and curiosity. And, you know, again, when I name, once I start naming it, just sounds like, oh, I have faith in the kids. But I don't know. It is really, it's really like, I'm like, okay, maybe that's our little helium balloon out of all this is all these kids. So the children. I can't believe my answer is the children, but my answer is really the children.
Some things are sort of cliche for a reason. You know what I mean? Like some things just have a real persistence because they are fundamental. And that iteration of birth and death and that iteration of, you know, the sort of, why am I blanking on the title of the book? Oh my God. The Structure of Scientific Revolutions, the Thomas Kuhn book, like
that. Oh yeah. Yeah.
The story he tells, right?
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Right. And that like inconsistencies light the way. And I am not making up the piece. I'm such a sound nerd that I actually, this was truly yesterday. I recorded it if you want to hear it.
Yes, please.
What's this?
A dump truck.
A dump truck? What's this? Mail truck? And what's this one? Police truck?
Police truck.
Police truck?
Police truck.
Oh!
so sweet. Oh, gosh. Yeah, so profound, that those two words right there.
Mm-hmm.
Well, gosh, Lulu, I can't thank you enough for sharing your time with us today, for telling us about your process, for telling us about some of the big themes that came out of the book, your journey. And I don't know, I love these kinds of conversations. They tap in, obviously, to something that is really meaningful to me. And I just had a wonderful time sharing this time with you.
Oh, me too. Thank you for having me here. It's great. And thank you for just curating this space and giving people a space to talk about what they care about.
Yeah. Well, and everybody listening, thank you for being involved, coming back week after week. I'm really looking forward to the next time we all get together to talk nerdy.